Welcome to Between the Lines, presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. This week we present Robert Edgar, General Secretary of the National Council of Churches, who explains why many religious leaders are opposed to the Bush administration's drive for a new war against Iraq. Dr. Helen Caldicott, anti-nuclear activist and founder of the Nobel Prize-winning group Physicians for Social Responsibility, who discusses her fear that a future U.S. war against Iraq could involve the use of nuclear weapons. And attorney Nancy Chang, with the Center for Constitutional Rights, who describes the impact of the USA Patriot Act and Bush administration executive orders on the erosion of civil liberties since the 9/11 terrorist attacks. But first, we begin with a summary of some of the week's underreported news stories.
The Guardian Weekly newspaper reports that tens of thousands of black farm workers in Zimbabwe were displaced by land seizures of white-owned farms that were ordered by President Robert Mugabe. According to the Zimbabwe Community Development Trust, at least 150,000 farm workers were evicted from white-run farms by government allies in recent months. The number balloons to 750,000 when all of the family members of the farm workers are included. Trust Director Canon Timothy Neal lamented, "The numbers are mind-boggling. The overwhelming number have no place to go, and on average, they have sufficient food for 54 days. In 2 months, we're going to have this huge group go hungry." Meanwhile, the Zimbabwe Parliament is debating new legislation to speed up the seizure of white-owned farms, yet the allies of President Mugabe have refused to acknowledge the growing crisis of black farm workers. Farm worker James Sani was beaten by Mugabe supporters who have harassed white farmers. His only choice was to run with his family to seek safety. He now lives in a tent city full of farm worker refugees. Many other evicted farm workers are not so lucky. They have lost Zimbabwe citizenship because their parents were born in the nations of Malawi and Mozambique. They are now considered permanent residents and have no right to farmland. The tragedy of this ongoing conflict is that legitimate grievances over land distribution have been subsumed in corrosive nationalism and squabbles over political power. The news magazine In These Times reports that white extremist groups are working to infiltrate the global social justice movement. In recent months, the Neo-Nazi National Alliance has been the most active in organizing under the banner of Taxpayers Against Terrorism that attracted several hundred followers in a late August rally full of anti-Israel rhetoric. It follows a string of concerts last spring by hate rock groups such as Brutal Attack and Celtic Warrior that have dovetailed with the protests against Israel's brutal tactics in reoccupying Palestinian land. National Alliance activist Bill White often posts messages on the indymedia.org website with pleas for the anti-globalism movement to include divergent and marginalized voices, such as those supporting white supremacy. Pro-Palestinian activist David Finkel of Against the Current magazine notes, "Fascists and racists of all types usually strike a pose of anti-globalism or sometimes anti-capitalism. They also try to identify with Palestinians when in reality their real agenda is promoting hatred of Jews." In its relentless drive to be America's no-frills retailer, Walmart doesn't mess around with union sympathizers. The company squashes them. Months after voting for a union at the Walmart Supercenter in Jacksonville, Texas, meat cutter Joe Hendricks was fired for not paying for nachos when he ordered them at the in-house snack bar. 73-year-old Sidney Smith, another pro-union worker at the store, was fired for eating a banana at the checkout line. Walmart, the world's biggest retailer, is the king of the discounts, using a winning formula created by founder Sam Walton. It is a simple recipe: keep labor costs low, even if it results in high worker turnover or unfair labor practices. Through the years, union organizers have faced many obstacles in organizing at Walmart, as the store burns through 70% of new hirees every year. But the discounter may have fumbled with a new health plan it offers their full-time employees. Last year, Walmart increased health insurance premiums 30%, and single parents with family coverage must now pay $36 a week plus a $350 deductible for each family member. All told, it adds up to about $3,000 annually, a big hit for employees making just $16,000 a year. The United Food and Commercial Workers have recently gotten more serious about organizing at Walmart. The union campaign is most heated in Las Vegas, where Walmart is opening 5 new stores. The UFCW pulled the plug on a recent election after Walmart hired new workers at one store in violation of federal guidelines. This week's news summary was compiled by Bob Nixon. For Between the Lines, I'm Jeff Wignall.
As President Bush continued his campaign to gather U.S. and international support to launch a new war against Iraq, opponents of his policy have taken to the streets across the globe. In recent weeks, hundreds of thousands of citizens in Britain, Italy, and Spain have voiced strong objections to their government's support for the Bush Doctrine, justifying a preemptive strike against the government of Saddam Hussein. Here in the U.S., tens of thousands have also poured into the streets, expressing their opposition to the White House drive for war. Protests organized by the Not in Our Name Coalition and other groups have been held in major cities and towns across the country, including New York, San Francisco, Seattle, and Portland, Oregon. Even as Congress was poised to approve House and Senate resolutions giving the president broad authority to initiate a war, with or without United Nations backing, national religious leaders were taking a stand against what many believe will be an unprovoked attack on Iraq. 49 heads of American Protestant and Orthodox churches and Catholic religious orders recently signed a letter to President Bush opposing U.S. military action against Baghdad. Between the Lines, Scott Harris spoke with Robert Edgar, General Secretary of the National Council of Churches, a signer of the letter, and a former 6-term member of the U.S. Congress. Dr. Edgar explains why he and other religious leaders are opposed to the Bush administration's war plans.
Well, the National Council of Churches represents some 50 million people in 36 different member communions. And if you add the opposition that the Roman Catholic Church has provided and several other religious leaders across the country, we're probably representing about a million Christians who have concern about the unintended consequences of the president's action. None of us support Saddam Hussein. None of us think that he is nothing more than a brute. But we feel that going into war is a question that needs to be done slowly and with thoughtfulness, and should not be done unilaterally or even bilaterally with Great Britain, but in fact should have the family of nations coming together in a common cause. Some of the unintended consequences that we're worried about include the civilians that will be impacted if we begin bombing Iraq. We see all these pictures of Saddam Hussein holding up a rifle, but we don't see the pictures of children holding up an empty bowl asking for food. In the last 50 years, every war has been calculated to have more than 50% of the combatants wounded and dead have been civilians, and in this case, we think that number will be very high. The other unintended consequence that we're concerned about is the destabilization even further of the Middle East. Already, the level of violence between Israel and Palestine is extreme. We've heard comments from Ariel Sharon that if the United States attacks Iraq and Iraq lobs even a conventional weapon at Israel, there's no holding back the fury of Israel. Israel also has nuclear weapons, and we could be pushing very close to a major confrontation. Our hope is that saner heads will prevail, that we will look for diplomatic solutions, we will work with the United Nations to put the inspectors back in, and we will turn our attention to really trying to seek peace, not war, in the Middle East.
Critics of President Bush's doctrine of preemptive strikes fear that this could set a precedent, a dangerous precedent, for other countries who are in confrontation with each other and thereby legitimize preemptive wars in the future. What are your concerns about that?
I absolutely believe believe that. I think that's one of the unintended consequences of our action that we need to be very cautious about. Think about it. Pakistan is ruled by a leader who took over by a military coup. He holds weapons of mass destruction, including nuclear and biological weapons. What if India took this as an opportunity to attack Pakistan, to rid Pakistan of weapons of mass destruction? What if China took out Taiwan? What if North Korea took out South Korea, or South Korea took out North Korea? I mean, we can proliferate a number of conflicts based on our modeling.
In recent weeks, phone calls have been pouring into congressional offices opposing the war by 100 to 1 or upwards of 500 to 1 by some reports. You have been lobbying Congress to turn back a resolution that would give President Bush broad authority to initiate a war. What was your experience in speaking with congressional representatives and their staff?
My experience was that their staff was more supportive of opposing the president than the members of the House and Senate were. Many of them are frightened to stand up to the President of the United States this close to an election. Since 9/11, Democrats particularly have been very weak-kneed about their ability to confront the administration and try to temper and tone some of the policies of the administration. I think the elected officials themselves are operating often by fear of not getting elected than what's in the best interest of the country, and that's a very sad thing to watch.
If President Bush does initiate a war against Iraq, what kind of divisions and schisms will we see here at home in the United States?
Well, just among our Christian communions, there'll be divisions. We have a number of living peace churches that will do acts of nonviolent civil disobedience to oppose the war, and others that will support the president. A fear that I have and have had since 9/11 is that the growing Muslim population in our nation will come increasingly under attack. We've already seen Arabs and particularly those who are of the Muslim faith detained without access to family or lawyers. I have seen since 9/11 the erosion of civil liberties, victories we thought we won in the 50s and 60s, moving away from McCarthyism, moving away from the old policies of the FBI and CIA. And I think if war breaks out, there'll be an increasing divide. I was a member of Congress in April of 1975 when we shut down the Vietnam War. I know how hard it is to shut down a war and how easy it is to start a war, and I just hope that sounder heads and calmer policies will pervade over the next few months and that we won't find ourselves a month or two down the road in a war that will be difficult not only to stop, but the unintended consequences will be unpredictable on a day-to-day basis.
That was Robert Edgar, General Secretary of the National Council of Churches. Contact the Council of Churches by calling area code 212-870-2511 or visit their website at www.nccusa.org. Dr. Helen Caldicott is a pediatrician and world-renowned anti-nuclear weapons activist. She founded Physicians for Social Responsibility in 1978 because of her grave concern over the biological impact of nuclear weapons on the human race. The group has 20,000 members who are doctors, nurses, or other health professionals. The Australian-born Caldicott, who now lives in the U.S., was nominated for the Nobel Peace Prize for her efforts. In her latest book titled The New Nuclear Danger, George Bush's Military-Industrial Complex, Caldicott explains why she fears that a future U.S. war against Iraq could involve the use of nuclear weapons. Dr. Caldicott emphasizes that the first war against Iraq in 1991 was a nuclear war because of the use of depleted uranium weapons. She points to studies that show an increase in birth deformities and an increase in specific types of cancers, especially in Iraq, but also among the offspring of U.S. service personnel who served in the Gulf War. Between the Lines' Melinda Tuhus recently spoke with Helen Caldicott in New Haven, Connecticut, where she spoke of the militarization of the U.S. government and the dangerous precedent set in the Bush Doctrine justifying preemptive wars and regime change.
The problem is that I think there's a 50-50 chance they'll use nuclear weapons in Iraq. The Pentagon's been mooting this for quite a while. They're called robust earth penetrators, which sounds quite masculine to me. And they're probably made of depleted uranium. Now, the last war in Iraq was a nuclear war. America used up to 800 tons of depleted uranium weapons that explode or burn on hitting a tank, producing tiny little particles of respirable size. And people can breathe them into their lungs. It's quite radioactive. Its half-life is 4.5 billion years, so many parts of Iraq are permanently contaminated with radioactive material. And the incidence of childhood cancer in some areas has gone up 6 to 12 times. Women are too frightened to give birth because they're giving birth to monsters, babies with single eyes, with no brains and the like. The incidence of congenital deformities has doubled. Meanwhile, the veterans from that Gulf War or massacre are excreting uranium in their semen, the American veterans, and their urine, and they are having a higher than normal incidence of babies being born with congenital malformations. So we're talking about something very profound from a medical and a moral perspective.
Do you know anything about Iraq's weapons of mass destruction and whether they have nuclear capability or will soon have it?
Absolutely. If you just read what Cheney says, who's the vice president, really the president, he says they do not have any nuclear weapons, and the CIA said they do not, and only if they can get some fissile material, which is most unlikely, unless they steal it from Russia, could they possibly make nuclear weapons. Scott Ritter, the main weapons inspector, denies that they have weapons of mass destruction, and the truth is that America's satellites are so refined these days, they know exactly what's happening in Iraq. The CIA report presented to Bob Graham, who is the chairman of the Senate Intelligence Committee, was not definitive at all in saying they had weapons of mass destruction. So it's all a subterfuge. You know why they want to go in. I mean, they're lying. They're lying. And why they want to go in is because they want the oil. And they talk about regime change, not just in Iraq, but they're talking about regime change or destroying governments in Iran, in Libya, and China. And China is the next major enemy which America is trying to set up as the new Cold War enemy. This sounds a little crazy, but these right-wing people who run this administration have been writing about this for some years and produced a major paper in the year 2000 that America is going to virtually take over the world. And you know that because you're reading that in the newspapers these days and hearing it on television. I have to tell you, I've been in Europe and the world is aghast. And I just spoke to a 94-year-old woman, a wonderful woman in California. She said, our country's been hijacked, and it has. And I just want to say another thing. It reminds me of Germany, and it reminds me of the dictum that says the only way evil flourishes is for good people to do nothing. And what they're planning in Iraq could initiate a global nuclear war between Russia and America, who still have each other targeted with 2,500 hydrogen bombs, and that's the end of us. Because you only need 1,000 bombs to create nuclear winter and the end of life on Earth. So nuclear weapons used in Iraq could trigger the early warning system in Russia or America and start the whole thing off. So we're skating not just on thin ice, but the edge of the nuclear precipice.
Do you think without September 11th, the Bush administration would have been able to get this far in its plans for hegemony, as a lot of people see it?
No. How dare America do this? I mean, how dare they? And then they say, well, Hussein wasn't democratically elected, neither was Bush. I mean, Hussein could just as well say, well, America doesn't have a democratically elected president, we'll go and produce a regime change in America. You see, it's a precedent that creates the most extraordinary situation for the world, because India could just now say, well, we'll go and have a regime change in Pakistan.
Using nuclear weapons.
Absolutely, and they are very likely to do that because the situation is very tense on, you know, in Kashmir and the Pakistani-Indian border, and they're both armed with nuclear weapons, and I don't think they really understand the real human significance of nuclear weapons. I mean, it's hard for these men to understand what nuclear weapons really mean. I mean, where really, and where are the women? 53% of the Earth's population are women. What are we doing? Just sitting there watching while our children and grandchildren may have no future?
That was Dr. Helen Caldicott, author of The New Nuclear Danger, George W. Bush's Military-Industrial Complex, published by The New Press. Contact Dr. Caldicott's Nuclear Policy Institute at area code 213-386-1901 or visit their website at www.nuclearpolicy.org. While the Bush administration is gearing up for a new war with Iraq, the nation is still trying to absorb the many changes made to the U.S. legal system since the September 11th terrorist attacks. Only 6 weeks after the assaults on the World Trade Center and the Pentagon, the White House pushed for and received near unanimous backing from Congress for new measures Mr. Bush said were necessary to fight the war on terrorism. With almost no debate or public hearings, the USA Patriot Act was signed into law, curtailing the civil liberties of citizens and non-citizens more sharply than at any time since World War II. The U.S. government now has wide latitude to hold individuals in secret detention, withhold legal counsel, and spy on people engaged in lawful religious and political activity. Despite some recent court decisions ruling that the Bush administration's practice of holding deportation hearings in secret was illegal, the erosion of civil liberties continues to alarm growing numbers of citizens. Between the Lines, Scott Harris spoke with Nancy Chang, the senior litigation attorney with the Center for Constitutional Rights. She discusses the historical and contemporary attempts to weaken critical provisions of the U.S. Bill of Rights, described in her new book titled Silencing Political Dissent, How Post-September 11th Anti-Terrorism Measures Threaten Our Civil Liberties.
The act gives the administration, the Bush administration, basically a wish list of surveillance tools that has been sought for a decade during the Clinton administration and during the Bush administration prior to September 11th, a lot of these powers have been sought and denied by the Congress. But with the September 11th attacks, and then if you'll remember, in October of 2001, when the act was passed, Congress had been evicted from its offices with anthrax contamination, and we had been told that there were going to be additional terrorist threats. So at that point in time, the Congress basically gave the administration vast powers, including the powers to conduct nationwide roving wiretaps and to go after records that are involved in a terrorist investigation, but that need not be limited solely to the records of individuals suspected of terrorism. Law-abiding Americans could find their records covered by this as well. So in addition to the area of privacy, there is a provision of the act that creates a new crime, one of domestic terrorism, and it is a crime that is so broadly described that many of us are concerned that it will chill speech and it will chill people from engaging in acts of civil disobedience. I can just describe this law to you briefly. It extends to any acts that are dangerous to human life, that are a violation of the criminal laws, if they appear to be intended to influence the policy of a government by intimidation or coercion, and if they occur primarily within the territorial jurisdiction of the United States. When you have such a loose definition, it could basically lump together civil disobedience that is nonviolent in the tradition of Thoreau or Gandhi or King, together with genuine terrorists, Al-Qaeda's network, all under the single banner of terrorism. And I think this is going to have a negative impact on freedom of speech.
There are many politicians who support the USA Patriot Act and other measures taken by the Bush administration, and they have been quoted often as saying the Bill of Rights is not a suicide pact, that we need to balance our civil liberties here in the U.S. against the real threat represented by terrorism of the sort visited upon us September 11th. How do you respond to the idea that we do have to sacrifice some of our civil liberties to ensure our security?
Yes, the Constitution is not a suicide pact, but if the Bill of Rights provides us with protections that are permanent, none of the provisions in the Bill of Rights are measures that disappear or are rescinded in times of war or crisis. We do have an Article 1 of the Constitution, the suspension clause that allows the Congress to suspend the writ of habeas corpus, and that's the procedure in which one goes to federal court to seek the release of an individual who's being held unconstitutionally or illegally. But the Bill of Rights is a permanent part of our legal landscape. However, it sets forth a number of very flexible tests, the First Amendment, the Due Process Clause, the Fourth Amendment. They all look to and consider what the government's interests are in a particular restriction. If the government has a compelling national security interest that's at stake, that will be considered by the court. But on the other hand, the court is not going to accept a blanket across-the-board rule that's not closely tailored or narrowly tailored to the government's interests. We're in a time in which the government is citing security reasons for keeping many matters secret from us. And this is a dangerous period for democracy. When the public and the press have the facts kept from them, it's hard to engage in intelligent public discourse. Yet, we're on the precipice of war with Iraq, and it is precisely at times like this when we need that full, healthy, vigorous discourse. There are so many lives that are at stake if our country goes to war. There are questions of how we will be perceived in the world if we engage in a preemptive strike without the support of the UN and other nations. There are questions about the long-term repercussions of such an attack, and we need to be discussing these matters fully and frankly.
Are you optimistic that we can repair the damage done in this time of crisis following September 11th and the invocation of the USA Patriot Act?
There are provisions of the Patriot Act that are permanent. Most of them are, but there are a few provisions that are scheduled to sunset 4 years after they were enacted, basically in December of 2005. I think it's a really strong rallying point for people who are concerned about this issue to take to their representatives in Congress and to seek the repeal of the provisions of the Patriot Act that undermine our civil liberties and demand that our Congress conduct proper oversight of the Department of Justice and the executive branch on its implementation of the act. So I'm hopeful, but it will take all of us who are concerned about this to speak out and protest and make our views known.
That was Attorney Nancy Chang, author of Silencing Political Dissent, published by Seven Stories Press. Contact the Center for Constitutional Rights by calling area code 212-614-6464 or visit their website at www.ccr-ny.org. You've been listening to Between the Lines, a weekly program presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. Between the Lines is produced at the studios of WPKN Radio. If you have suggestions for topics and guests, or would like a recording of today's program, please contact Between the Lines by calling area code 203-331-9756, or write to Between the Lines, care of WPKN Radio, 244 University Avenue, Bridgeport, Connecticut, 06604. You can also visit our website at www.btlonline.org. Our theme music was written and performed by Mikata. This week's program was produced by Scott Harris, with the assistance of Anna Manzo, Harry Minot, Bob Nixon, Melinda Tuhus, Jeff Yates, and Jeff Wignall. For Between the Lines, I'm Sasha Summer-Cousineau.